Welcome to Inside Vancouver Opera. My name is Ashley Daniel Foote. Did you know that Georges Bizet, the composer of Carmen, was a musical prodigy who started composing at the age of 9? Today, the life and times of Georges Bizet. This is a rebroadcast of a series we released last year, but today, we're playing it for you in its entirety. Written and edited by Chris Epps, with Felix LeBlanc as the voice of Georges Bizet, narration by Jane Potter, and additional voices from Ashley Daniel Foote, Travis Bowellen, Vincent Wynn, and many others.
Music. What a beautiful act. But what a wretched profession. I see no one I can like or even respect. This so-called artistic milieu is no better than the gutter. Their life is not a cruel joke. If intelligence and sensitivity are not malformations of the moral system, burdens we must bear. Music. I would like to fly this country, escape my kind from this hateful world to which I am riveted.
The year is 1838. The Industrial Revolution is winding down, and the great gold rush is on the horizon. In Morristown, New Jersey, Samuel Morse of the famed Morse Code is giving the first public demonstration of his new invention, the telegraph. An ailing Frédéric Chopin, wintering on the Mediterranean with his lover, the writer Georges Sand, is hard at work on his 24 preludes for piano. Over in England, royalists are celebrating the coronation of their new queen, Victoria, while others queue for the first installment of Charles Dickens' new novel, Nicholas Nickleby. and across the English Channel on October the 25th. The composer Georges Bizet is born on a bustling street in the famous Montmartre district of Paris. He was born Alexandre César Léopold, but 2 years later was baptized Georges. It was this name he was known by to his family and friends for the rest of his life. His father, Adolphe Bizet, descended from artisan stock in Rouen, capital of the northern French region of Normandy. Until his marriage in 1837, he made his living as a hairdresser and wig maker. He then became a singing teacher and a modest composer, writing a handful of compositions that are now long forgotten. Georges' mother, Aimée Delsart, also came from a musical family. By all accounts, she was a highly intelligent, eccentric woman, as well as a talented pianist. Her letters to Georges, her only child, paint a picture of a homely, affectionate, and doting mother, despite her lifelong struggles with chronic illness. Having the good fortune of having hailed from a musical household, it was his mother who gave Georges his first piano lesson. As with all child prodigies, stories abound of their youthful displays of genius and exceptional skill. Georges is no exception. He spent many an afternoon with his ear pressed against his father's studio door, listening with great fascination to him giving voice lessons. One afternoon, Adolphe called his young son into the room and asked him to sing a piece, at sight. To his astonishment and sheer delight, Georges began to sing the piece he'd just heard, not only perfectly in tune, but completely memorized. Having lofty ambitions, as well as acknowledging his own limitations, it was the conservatoire on which Adolphe had set his sights firmly for his young son. The prestigious Conservatoire de Paris was founded in 1795. An institution steeped in French music tradition, it boasts amongst its former students a wealth of French musicians: Hector Berlioz, Claude Debussy, Maurice Ravel, Gabriel Fauré, have all left their indelible marks on its rich musical heritage. Adolphe's only concern was that Georges, at 9 years old, did not meet the minimum age of 10 for enrollment at the Conservatoire. Never one to cede, Adolphe went to see Joseph Mayfred, a prominent horn player and member of the Committee of Studies, to see what could be done. When presented with the boy, Mayfred was skeptical.
Your child is very young.
True, but if he is small in stature, he is big in knowledge.
Really? What can he do?
Sit down at the piano, strike some chords, and he will name them without a mistake.
F-sharp minor 7, sir.
You, my boy, will go to the conservatoire.
On October 9th, 1848, 2 weeks before his 10th birthday, Georges entered the Conservatoire de Paris, everyone unaware that this eager and precocious young boy would one day change the very course of opera as we know it today. Barely 6 months after his admission to the Conservatoire, Georges had already made a sizable impression, attracting the attention of Pierre Zimmermann, the Conservatoire's former professor of piano, who agreed to come out of retirement to teach him counterpoint and fugue. When Zimmermann fell ill, it was none other than the great French composer Charles Gounod who took over the boy's training. Here began a musical admiration and lifelong friendship which had significant effects on Georges' musical style. At the age of 12, Georges entered the piano class of Antoine-François Marmontel. He had great admiration for his teacher, later writing,
"In your class, one learns something besides piano. One becomes a musician."
Although famed as a composer, Bizet's skills as a pianist are not to be underestimated. He was a brilliant virtuoso, and later became an equally skilled organist. ...1853 saw new musical horizons for Georges. The 15-year-old entered the composition class of Fromental Alevi. Alevi, himself a composer of opera, was to become a prominent figure in Georges' life. In fact, the entire Alevi family became a source of great inspiration, joy, and oftentimes misery for the young composer. Alevi's brother, Léon, and his nephew, Ludovic, were both Bizet's librettists later in his career, and Georges would marry Alevi's daughter, Geneviève, 16 years later. Many of Georges's early compositions are preserved at the Conservatoire. His most significant work from this period was his first symphony, which ultimately became his only foray into the traditional symphonic realm. A delightful work in C major, Georges began writing the symphony just 4 days before his 17th birthday. Ever the expeditious worker, it was completed only 1 month later. Not uncommon of the times, the work was never published and did not come to light until its first performance in 1935. It has since become a perennial favorite for orchestras around the globe. Around the time of his first symphony, Alevi deemed Georges ready to compete for the esteemed Prix de Rome, a French scholarship for composition students offering a 5-year pension to study in Rome and other prominent European musical centers. A highly desirable financial freedom for any budding composer, as well as the highest honor France can bestow upon a young artist. As time went on, Bizet found himself a part of the inner circle of French musicians, often attending Friday night parties of Jacques Offenbach, the French operette king. It was there that he met the famous Giacomo Rossini, who at the time was the toast of the Paris opera scene. Bizet had great admiration for the 62-year-old master.
Rossini is the greatest of them all, because, like Mozart, he has all the virtues.
Rossini was kind to the young composer and presented Georges with a signed photograph as well as cordial letters which Georges used on his forthcoming travels in Italy. It is now 1857. The Prix de Rome weighed heavily on Bizet's shoulders. The committee was offering two prizes that year. The top winner, or laureate, would receive the full 5 years pension. The runner-up, a 4-year pension. The jury, selected from the musical section of the Académie des Beaux-Arts, had difficulty making their decision, vacillating between Bizet and another promising musician. Ultimately, Georges was unanimously awarded the first prize. Crowned with the country's highest artistic distinction, as well as a brilliant conservatory career, Bizet is now off to Rome. But he knows all too well the Prix de Rome is merely a stepping stone, offering few advantages after the 5-year pension, very little help in getting his works performed, and certainly no guarantee for a favorable reaction from the fickle French public. In the words of his teacher and mentor, Charles Gounod,
"Now your real artistic life is going to begin. A serious and severe life it is."
Religion is a means of exploitation employed by the strong against the weak. Religion is a cloak of ambition, injustice, and vice. Truth breaks free. Silence is popularized. In a religion, daughters. Soon it will fall, in the course of centuries, that is, tomorrow. In good time, we shall only have to deal with reason. In good time, we shall only have to deal with reason.
Vancouver Opera presents Bizet, Life and Times. Act 3.
At the advanced age of 19, Bizet has won the prestigious Prix de Rome and is now setting off to Rome, where he will spend the next 3 years in deep self-discovery, basking in the Italian landscape and dedicating himself to his true passion. But with great honor comes great responsibility. Winners are required to submit one major composition each of the 5 years. These works, called envoi, are to be submitted to the Académie des Beaux-Arts. In return, two critiques are issued, one for publication and one for the artist personally. Georges left Paris the 21st of December, 1857, on a route that would take him through Lyon, Vienna, Valence, Avignon, Nice, Pisa, and Florence before landing in Rome. His letters are full of delightful observations of the visual splendors along the way.
It is a magnificent country. The spectacle of nature is something unknown to me. I find it impossible to analyze my impressions. An artist ought to profit by it, be he painter or musician, sculptor or architect.
Arriving in Italy early in the new year, his impressions were less than favorable. Despite the love for the scenery, he was mostly disgusted by the architecture.
Ugh, churches painted like monuments in cardboard.
And with the people, whom he perceived to be all priests and beggars.
The Piedmontese have several ways of begging, humbly by day and with a blunderbuss by night.
The Paris convoy of artists arrived in Rome on January 27th. Living a communal life, they made their home at the French Academy, hosted at the Villa Medici, a 16th century monastery standing high on Mount Pincio, overlooking Rome in all its grandeur. Given Bizet's nature, it was not long before he acquired social success. Within a month, he had triumphed as a pianist, attended masked balls, dined with the Russian ambassador, and was up to his ears in private invitations. Never spoiled by social success, he was always aloof from his actions. On one occasion, after drawing a particularly enthusiastic ovation at an evening salon performance, his reaction was lackluster.
It is only fair to say that there are no pianists in Italy. And if you can play the scale of C major with both hands, you pass for a great pianist.
Fellow pensioners were more than a little jealous of Bizet's popularity, but he paid no heed. His opinions were already well formed.
I have success in living very peacefully with 15 of them. The other 5 are utterly ridiculous, as I keep telling them to their considerable irritation.
Regardless of his youthful preconceptions, Bizet possessed a special gift for friendship. Despite his hair-trigger temper and disdain for deception, he demanded and gave complete frankness and loyalty, and was always swift to withdraw any harsh remark or unfair judgment. It was 1 month after his arrival in Rome that he began to work on his Te Deum, his only sacred work aside from his Ave Maria. The motivation for the work was the Rodriguez Prize, a competition for new religious works open to Prix de Rome winners. He began in February 1858 and finished in May. The manuscript survives, but it was not performed until 1970. Bizet, a self-proclaimed atheist, had no feeling for sacred music. His reaction to his new composition was ambiguous.
I don't know what to think of it. Sometimes I find it good, sometimes detestable. What is certain is that I'm not cut out to write religious music. I shall send an Italian opera in 3 acts. I like that better.
In the end, he lost the prize to the only other contestant. With his first envoi deadline fast approaching, Bizet searched high and low for a suitable text, sifting through
all the libraries in Rome and reading 200 pieces.
He finally found what he was searching for in a used bookstall in a back alley. It was the Italian farce Don Procopio by Carol Cambiaggio. Bizet was thrilled.
I am decidedly built for la musique bouffe, and I lose myself in it completely. On Italian words, one must write Italian music. I have not tried to cast off this influence.
It was the Academy's rules that all winners submit a sacred work as their first envoi. Always one to challenge authority, Bizet completed and submitted his new 2-act opera, Don Procopio. With no mention of his defiance, the Academy's reviews were favorable.
In short, Don Procopio is distinguished by an easy and brilliant touch, a youthful and bold style, precious qualities for the genre of comedy, towards which the composer shows a marked propensity. Those qualities open the way to novel efforts, and Monsieur Bizet will not forget the obligation he has undertaken as much towards himself as towards us.
Bizet felt encouraged.
I feel more confident than ever, though I don't conceal from myself the immense progress that remains to be achieved before I get anywhere, but I have good hopes.
Ever the disciplined artist, he immediately set to work on his next 2 submissions. With a second wind of ambition, his intentions were to write a musical setting for Victor Hugo's Esmeralda, as well as another symphony. But as was often the case in his life, the best-laid plans of mice and men often went awry. He began to experience severe doubts, questioning his abilities to compose. He had gone from working fluently with little vision and great imagination to paralyzing self-doubt. In a letter to Gounod, he explained,
I flounder a lot and progress a little. I have always been very much the student. It is not easy to become oneself. I mistrust my facility. I have around me 10 intelligent fellows who will never be more than mediocre artists, and all because the fatal confidence with which they abandon themselves to their cleverness. Cleverness in art is almost insensible, but it only ceases to be dangerous the moment the man and the artist find themselves.
Few compositions projected in Italy by Bizet ever reached completion. In fact, this was true throughout his entire professional life. He spent the next few months vacillating between works, endlessly contemplating the best artistic path forward. His planned symphony was now to be his second envoi, but after several weeks it went into the fire. Abandoning Hugo, he set to work on his choral symphony, Vasco da Gama, and he was very pleased.
Whatever a gentleman of the Academy says, my opinion is formed, and it is good. Very good, even.
It was in July 1860 that Bizet left Rome with his friend, Guillot. The 3 years had been the happiest of his life. He adored the climate and the countryside, the character of each street and the secondhand bookshops, the museums and the art galleries.
I shall cry murder if a single piece of art is removed.
Bizet did not want to leave. He had an emotional send-off. People he never cared for shook his hand with tearful eyes.
I had a frightful attack of nerves. I wept for 6 hours straight off. I realized that I was liked at the Academy, and that was very moving.
His travel diary shows a young man eager to sample all of life's offerings. He writes of architecture, painting and sculpture, of playing organ at churches along the way, and of his insatiability for prostitutes. It was on this return journey that the germ for his Roma Symphony was born, a work that would consume most of his life.
I have in my mind a symphony which I would like to call Roma, Venice, Florence, and Naples. That works out wonderfully. Venice will be my andante, Florence my scherzo, and Naples my finale. It's a new idea, I think.
Upon arriving in Venice, Bizet received a letter from his ailing mother, which sent him into a fit of despair. It was inconceivable to him that he may lose the very being that he most needed at the onset of his career. The mere possibility of being deprived of his mother's nurturing and guidance led his already mercurial nature down an even darker path. The duo decided to end the tour and return to Paris immediately, hoping the cruel fate of time was on their side.
It is a magnificent country. I realized that I was liked at the Academy, and that was very moving. I flounder a lot and progress little. I have always been very much the student. It is not easy to become oneself. I feel more confident than ever.
Vancouver Opera presents Bizet, Life and Times.
When Bizet returned to Paris in 1860, France was in the throes of the Second French Empire, an 18-year imperial Bonapartist regime of Napoleon III, which spanned from 1852 to 1870. This made life challenging for all professional musicians. The only open road for a contemporary composer with serious ambition and without private means was almost exclusively the stage. At the time, there were two permanent opera houses in Paris, the Opéra, regarded as the premier national theater, and the Opéra Comique. Opera had originally been an aristocratic form of art, and it was at the opera that this tradition endured, although heirs of the French Revolution had made great effort to bring it within the comprehension of the middle classes. The opera was little more than a salon for snobs, the audience more interested in the latest fashions than the performance. The attitudes struck against their own composers were most telling. For almost three centuries, the accepted music in France was exclusively composed by foreigners. Lully in the 17th century, Gluck in the 18th, and Rossini in the 19th century. Although only marginally better, the Opéra Comique was more supportive of native talent. With its clear, elegant, polished, and often vulgar music, it was designed to cater to the Paris bourgeois. It had originated over a century earlier as a parody of the tragic stage. At the time, neither theater was in a state of healthful growth, placing profit ahead of art at every opportunity. Outside of these two state theaters were the Théâtre Lyrique, mostly successful with revivals of foreign works translated into French, and the Théâtre Italien, which fed the craze for Italian opera and operetta, over which, by 1850, Jacques Offenbach reigned supreme. The prima donnas of the day were another great source of consternation for every young composer. The stories of their capacity to exert artistic control over every aspect of the production are legendary. It was fully expected that the composer would adapt their musical style to suit the particular singer. Failure to accommodate would often result in a very public ostracizing. The attitudes of the directors were little better, as their goals were purely financial. They regarded the opera score not as a piece of art, but as material they could manipulate and present in the most lucrative way. Yet another problem was the highly inflammatory and deplorable level of the musical criticism. At every opportunity, critics displayed prejudice, conservatism, and ignorance. Camille Saint-Saëns, a contemporary and lifelong friend of Bizet, quotes one of the most brilliant reviews by Théophile Gautier, a prominent music critic of the day.
A real duty, and it is a true kindness, is not to encourage these composers, but to discourage them. What use is it to encourage them and their efforts when the public obstinately refuses to pay attention to them?
With the lingering illness and ultimate death of his beloved mother in 1861, Bizet fell into a deep depression. In a letter to a close friend, he relates a dream, which provides a glimpse of his psychological state of mind.
At night, I would feel a terrible agony. I would be forced to throw myself down in an armchair, and then I would think I saw my mother coming into the room. She would cross and stand beside me and put her hand on my heart. Then the agony would increase. I would suffocate, and it seemed to me that her hand, weighing on me so heavily, was the true cause of my suffering.
Shortly before his mother's death, he told Gounod that he was conducting two love affairs. One was with his parents' maid, Marie Ritter, who produced a son, Jean, in 1862. Marie remained dedicated to the Bizets, nursing Georges during his last illness. The death of his mother at age 45 induced a lifelong fear of his own premature demise. Suffering from angina since the age of 14 and having regular attacks of articular rheumatism, he would often be bedridden with painful joints for weeks on end. Despite his recent trials and tribulations, he managed to finish his third envoi in the autumn of 1861, 1 year late. He had intended to submit a symphony, likely the Roma symphony he had projected a year earlier in Rome. Instead, he submitted two movements, the Scherzo and the Funeral March, with a supplemented overture. All were met with rave reviews. A fascinating anecdote from 1861 has Bizet's power and temperament on full display. One evening, he attended a dinner party of his former teacher, Alévi. The great Franz Liszt was also in attendance. After dinner, Liszt was persuaded to delight the company with one of his latest compositions. Naturally, its appalling difficulties and pyrotechnics rendered the crowd speechless. Being congratulated on his work and effortless execution, Liszt replied in kind.
Yes, it is a difficult piece, horribly difficult. And I only know two pianists in Europe capable of playing it as it is written and at the speed I desire. Hans von Bülow? And myself.
Recalling Bizet and his extraordinary memory, Alévi played a few chords on the piano, attempting to emulate what Liszt had just played, saying,
"Did you notice this passage, George?"
Bizet proceeded to play the whole passage from memory. Duly impressed, Liszt then produced the manuscript, at which point Bizet played the entire work without mistake or hesitation. Liszt took him by the hand, declaring,
"My young friend, I thought there were only two men able to surmount the difficulties with which it was my pleasure to adorn this piece. I was wrong. There are three, and in justice I should add that the youngest of the three is perhaps the most brilliant."
The retiring minister of fine art, Count Walewski, had recently given the Théâtre Lyrique a grant of 100,000 francs on condition that every 3 years, a three-act opera was to be written by a young winner of the Prix de Rome. It was Bizet's good fortune that he was the first to benefit under this new scheme. Léon Carvalho, the director of the Théâtre Lyrique, had met Bizet, and smitten by his charm and talent, offered him the libretto to Les Pêcheurs de Perles, the Pearl Fishers. Bizet eagerly signed the contract in April of 1863. The production was fixed for mid-September, giving him precious little time. He delivered the score in early August, and the opera premiered on September 30th. It received a rather tepid reception. Bizet was greeted with enthusiastic applause, and according to one account, was
a little dazed. His head was lowered and revealed only a forest of thick, curly hair above a round, still rather childish face, enlivened, however, by the quick, bright eyes which took in the whole hall with glances at once delighted and confused.
The tone of the press, however, was frigid and patronizing. He was accused of
harmonic bizarreries, born of a misdirected search for originality, an orgy of noise.
It was only the composer and respected critic Hector Berlioz who praised the work, writing that
the score of Les Pêcheurs de Perles does Monsieur Bizet the greatest honor, so that we shall be forced to accept him as a composer despite his rare talent as a sight reader.
Unfortunately, even Berlioz's positive appraisal did not spare Les Pêcheurs de Perles. The opera failed with the paying public and was only given 18 performances. It was not played again until 1886, at which time Bizet was both world famous and dead. At the age of 24, and with his Prix de Rome pension finally expiring, Bizet was now both financially and artistically insecure, having to resort to meaningless and oftentimes demeaning work. Regardless, his output was astonishing. He speaks of working 16 hours a day, experiencing frequent periods of exhaustion. Most nights were spent writing opera piano transcriptions, as well as orchestrations of hit songs of the day. He was also rehearsal pianist for the Opéra Lyrique, but still made time to have his patience frayed by talentless middle-class piano students who wanted nothing more than to play pretty salon pieces. It is important to remember Bizet not only as the brilliant stage composer that he was, but also the great pedagogue that he became. One of his early students, Edmond Gilbert, left a revealing and precise account of his brilliant teachings. When asked what books he had read, Bizet was delighted when Gilbert's list included his idols, Goethe and Schiller.
That settles it. People think you don't need any education to be a musician. They are wrong. You have to know a great deal.
The subject of fees made him adamant.
Don't ever mention that again. I give lessons for money because they bore me. With you, we are simply talking of things that interest us, things that we love. We are swimming in the same water.
Gilbert paid Bizet with wine from his father's vineyard. As a teacher of composition, he was no less opinionated.
Let yourself go. Aim at the emotions. Avoid dryness. Let us have fantasy, boldness, unexpectedness, enchantment, above all, tenderness. Morbidezza.
On orchestration.
No, no, no. That lacks air. And in orchestration, you must have air. Let each part have around it sufficient room to move.
When discussing the stage, his true passion, he could elaborate for hours.
It is the composer's obligation and sole duty to enter the skin of each character and interpret their inner feelings and desires. Never set two stanzas in different moods to the same music, and try to heighten the dramatic tension using musical motifs associated with a person or incident.
It was these musical tenets that were on full display in his new opera, La Jolie Fille de Perth. The contract for the opera was signed in July of 1866. Bizet said that the libretto was the worst of his life, having to take liberties to make any kind of dramatic effect with the music. This period is a prime example of Bizet's productive prowess. Act 1 was finished by September. While composing the opera, he was correcting proofs for publishers, scoring waltzes, and composing songs, all the while continuing work on his Roma Symphony. The opera was completed in October and was sent to Carvello on the 29th December, yet the production was delayed for 1 year. Bizet was furious.
Rehearse or the law courts. If I die of worry, discouragement, and also of hunger one of these fine days, it will occur to someone to do something about La Jolie Fille.
It was finally premiered on December 26, 1867, and Bizet was in very good spirits.
I am completely happy. Never did an opera have a better start. The dress rehearsal produced a great effect. The piece is very interesting. L'interprétation is most excellent. The costumes are rich. The settings are new. The director is a delight. The orchestration and singer are all of keenness. And what matters more than all that is the score of La Jolie Fille is a good piece of work. The orchestra gives it all a color, a relief that I admit I didn't dare hope for. I am sticking to my part. Now, forward. I must climb, climb, always climb. No more evening parties. No more fits and starts. No more mistresses. All that is finished. Absolutely finished. I am talking seriously. I have met an adorable girl whom I love. In 2 years, she will be my wife. From now on, nothing but work and reading. Thinking is life. I am talking seriously. I am convinced. I am of myself. The good has killed the evil. The victory has won.
The girl was Geneviève Allavie, the second daughter of Bizet's old teacher. As with most events in Bizet's life, the engagement was not without its drama. The Allavie family initially broke off the engagement, throwing Bizet into a fit of despair.
The hopes I have formed have been broken. The family has reserved its rights. I am very depressed. The blow I have received takes away all the hopes that were dear to me.
It is unclear why the family took such a stance. Bizet said later that they regarded him as
a bohemian and an outsider.
Nevertheless, they were eventually married in June of 1869. Not only was La Jolie Fille de Perth well performed, it was, more importantly, well received.
My work obtained a genuine and serious success. I was not hoping for a reception so enthusiastic and at the same time so severe. I have been taken seriously and had the great joy of moving and flipping an audience that was not predisposed in my favor. The press is excellent. Now, are we going to make money?
This time around, the press was indeed congenial, declaring the opera a masterpiece from beginning to end. Unfortunately, this did not spare the opera from suffering a similar demise as the Pearl Fishers. The opera had only 18 performances and disappeared from the Paris stage until 1890. His musical activities over the next 3 years were perplexing. He began at least 8 operas, only completing one, La Coupe du Roi de Tulle. While working on that opera, he at long last finished Roma, which was finally performed on the 28th of February, 1869, under the title Fantaisie Symphonique, Souvenir de Rome. Bizet's report was enthusiastic.
First movement, a round of applause, some hisses. Second round, a whistle. Third round, andante, a round of applause. Finale. Great effect. Applause 3 times repeated. Hisses. 3 or 4 whistles. In fact, a success.
Despite its positive reception, the symphony was largely ignored by the press. It was not heard again until 1880, 5 years after Bizet's death, the same year it was published under the title Roma. On June 3rd, 1869, Bizet married Geneviève Allavie. By all accounts, the early months of the marriage were happy ones. The newlyweds were very much in love. But already, there was friction on the horizon. Genevieve had a history of nervous and mental instability, which she inherited from both parents. Her mother, Léonie Alévi, regularly suffered periods of insanity, which forced the family to have her confined. Genevieve came from a tragic childhood. Her father passed away after a long illness when she was 13. 2 years later, her sister died suddenly at the age of 20. Léonie, in an episode of mental derangement, accused Genevieve of being responsible for her death. As a result, Genevieve could no longer live with her mother. Her diary shows she was a young girl haunted by fear and dread of the future. This resulted in constant demands for support and reassurance, especially from her new husband. Bizet's first major endeavor after his marriage was the completion of his father-in-law's biblical opera, Noé. After several fruitless attempts, the work was completed in October 1869. Also, in collaboration with the Opéra Comique, Bizet began work on three opera projects. In the end, none of them completed. These were Calendal, Grisalidas, and Clarissa Harlow. Unfortunately, all of his opera plans came to an abrupt end with the breakout of the Franco-Prussian War. In July 1870, Napoleon III, provoked by Bismarck, declared war on Prussia. Within a few short weeks, the Second Empire had fallen, the Emperor himself imprisoned, and Paris besieged. Bizet's reaction was immediate.
What will become of our poor philosophy, our dreams of universal peace, world fraternity, and human fellowship? Instead of all that, we have tears, blood, piles of corpses, crimes without number or end. I can't tell you, my dear friend, in what sadness I am plunged by all these horrors. I remember that I am a Frenchman, but I cannot altogether forget that I am a man. This war will cost humanity 500,000 lives. As for France, she will lose it all.
As a Prix de Rome winner, Bizet was exempt from the military. Regardless, a few days after war broke out, Bizet enlisted in the 6th Battalion of the National Guard. He remained with his wife in Paris throughout the months of siege, which ended with the armistice on the 26th of January, 1871. With the future of theater in post-war France uncertain, Bizet resumed work on Grisalidas and Clarissa Harlow, while also dealing with many personal problems, including Genevieve suffering another nervous breakdown. It seems at this point composing was a distraction from the many trials that life had thrown his way. The Opéra Comique was now under the joint management of two very different characters, Adolphe de Louvain, a true blue conservative, and Camille Duloc, who was more interested in exoticism, poetry, and symphonic elements. Of the two, it was Duloc who, wishing to attract up-and-coming young composers, made Bizet his mission, offering him the libretto to Jamile, a work based on Alfred de Musset's Namouna. Bizet was advised to get started at once. Initially, he found the subject
charming, but horribly difficult.
But later wrote,
it's very distinguished, very noble, artistically very significant. It will enable me to not be entirely forgotten by the public and will at the same time, I hope, be good for business.
He composed the score in a few weeks. A delightful accord has been left of Bizet during his composition.
He walked about in a straw hat and loose jacket, with the easy assurance of a country gentleman, smoking his pipe, chatting happily with friends, receiving them at the table with a conviviality that always had a touch of banter in it.
Aside from Jamile, Bizet was also working on a small yet delightful work of 12 pieces for piano duet, entitled Jeux d'enfants, later orchestrating 5 of these charming pieces. After many delays and endless frustration, Jemile was finally produced on the 22nd of May, 1872. Sadly, it was not the success Bizet had hoped for. No details were spared for the settings and costumes. However, the singers were grossly subpar. By the end, Bizet was a complete wreck.
There, a complete flop.
The scene from the audience was amusingly described.
It's infamous.
It's odious.
It's very funny.
What cacophony?
What audacity?
He's making fun of us all.
That's where the Wagner cult leads to madness.
Neither tonality, nor shape, nor rhythm.
It's no longer music, it's macaroni.
What? Is it Italian music?
No, I mean, but it is neither beginning nor end.
Jemile lasted for 11 performances and then disappeared until the Bizet centenary in 1938. Despite Jemile being generally panned, Bizet felt proud of his work.
What gives me more satisfaction than the opinion of these gentry is the absolute certainty of having found my path. I know what I am doing. I have just been ordered to compose 3 acts for the opera comique. It will be gay. But it's a gaiety that permits style.
Although the subject was not yet chosen, this was the genesis for Carmen. On the 10th of July, Bizet's son Jacques was born, and shortly after, his next commission arrived. Carvalho, the former director at the Opéra Lyrique, had migrated over to vaudeville, where straight plays were the flavor of the day. Not wishing to sever his connection with music, Carvalho revived the melodrama, a play with incidental music, and invited Bizet to write the score for Alphonse Daudet's L'Arlésienne. From this, a masterpiece was conceived in a matter of weeks. Bizet began work on Carmen in January 1873, with the goal of beginning rehearsals in October. Ultimately, things were pushed until August 1874. Bizet left the country to finish the score, settling in Bougival, a quiet spot on the Seine. It was there Carmen was finished, 1,200 pages of full orchestration in just under 2 months. Bizet was indeed pleased.
They make out that I am obscure, complicated, tedious, more fettered by technical skills than lit by inspiration. Well, this time I have written a work that is all clarifying and vivacity, full of color and melody. It will be amusing.
Célestine Galli-Marie was history's first Carmen in 1874. A great admirer of Bizet's music, she was very much struck by the part, and Bizet was equally struck by her suitability for the role. The backstage gossip at the Opéra Comique was that the two had a love affair, as well as frequent quarrels. There is no evidence of this, although Bizet's marriage was very unhappy at this time. It was a very trying 4 months of rehearsals for Bizet. Until the opera showed signs of success, he was met with a great deal of hostility from inside the theater. The orchestra resented the score's difficulty, deeming certain parts unplayable. The chorus were of the same mind, complaining that the music was impossible, as they were required to both act and watch the conductor. The first performance took place on the 3rd of March, and the reception was disappointing.
Act 1 was well received. Galli-Marie's first song applauded. End of the act good. Applause. A lot of people on the stage after this act. Bizet surrounded and congratulated. The second act, less fortunate. The opening, very brilliant. Great effect from the Toreador's entry, followed by coldness. From that point on, as Bizet deviated more and more from the traditional form of opera comique, the public was surprised, discountenanced, perplexed. Fewer people around Bizet between acts. Congratulations lessons here. Embarrassed, constrained. The coldness more marked in the third act. The only thing applauded was Michaela's aria of old classical cut. Still fewer people on the stage. And after the fourth act, which was glacial first to last, no one at all except 3 or 4 faithful and sincere friends of Bizet. They all had reassuring phrases on their lips, but sadness in their eyes. Carmen had failed.
When Bizet was congratulated by a fellow musician, his reaction was direct.
I sense a defeat. I foresee a definite and hopeless flop. This time, I am really sunk. Don't you see that all those bourgeois have not understood a wretched word of the work I have written for them?
To say that the libretto and the music of Carmen caused pandemonium in the press might be a bit of an understatement. The general consensus? Carmen is too obscene to be staged. It was said that Galli-Marie overemphasized the seamy side of her character to such an extent that
it would be difficult to go further without provoking the intervention of the police.
The opera was accused of having more scandal than truth, it being
a vulgar opera comique with a dash of the pathetic and a fine murder that is almost inexplicable.
The fact that Carmen had only 48 performances is not really telling of its true success in 1875. Due to poor support, it was nearly taken off the stage after 5 performances. However, 2 things kept it afloat: a tempting rumor that it was a shocking performance to watch, and Bizet's life tracking a final dramatic turn. Late in March 1875, Bizet had yet another attack of angina, but this was unlike the others. It was slow and incomplete and was accompanied by extreme depression. He was still deeply scarred over Carmen, exclaiming to a friend,
I've had enough of writing music to surprise 3 or 4 comrades who then go and scoff behind my back.
A close friend found him
torn between the raging desire to curse his judges and his terrors of believing them.
Others observed that he was haunted by the fear of an early death. The chain of events of the last few days of Bizet's life are chronicled as follows. It was said the husband and wife left for Bougival on May 28th. The first day went well. They walked hand in hand along the Seine, and Bizet enjoyed an afternoon bathe in the river. On the 30th, Bizet suffered a violent and incapacitating attack of rheumatism, accompanied by high fever, great pains, and depression. Partial recovery was followed on June 1st by a severe heart attack. A doctor was summoned on the morning of June 2nd, declaring the crisis over and prescribing strict bed rest. Suffering throughout the day with a high fever, the doctor was again sent for, but by the time he arrived, it was too late. Bizet died at 2 a.m. on June the 3rd. 2 hours after the curtain had fallen on the 33rd performance of Carmen and on his 6th wedding anniversary. Although the cause of death was never confirmed, it is largely believed that it was a cardiac complication of articular rheumatism. The funeral took place on June 5th and was attended by more than 4,000 people. Excerpts from Carmen and the Pearl Fishers were played on the organ. A makeshift orchestra performed his prelude from L'Elysium, as well as Chopin's Funeral March. Vocal numbers included the Agnus Dei and Pie Jesu from Act 1 of the Pearl Fishers. A wreath was placed from the young competitors of the Prix de Rome, who could not be present due to examinations. Bizet was interred in Père Lachaise Cemetery. The special performance of Carmen that evening was unbearably moving, and for the whole preceding week, Bizet was proclaimed a master. It is an interesting fact that the day before his death, Bizet signed a contract for Carmen's production in Vienna. It is from this production, which was praised by Wagner and Brahms, that its true success dates. It soon triumphed in St. Petersburg, London, Dublin, and New York. After many metamorphoses, Carmen was finally accepted by Paris society in 1883 with Galli-Marie at the helm, Carmen's original Carmen. It was Tchaikovsky who prophesied that within 10 years, Carmen would be the most popular opera in the world, and indeed it was, and remains so to this very day.
You've just heard a full rebroadcast of Bizet, Life and Times. We created that in 2022 for our production of The Pearl Fishers. It was written and edited by Chris Epps with additional editing by me, music supervision and clearances by Chris Epps and also me, and sound design by Chris Epps. The associate producer was Vincent Wynn. In the voice cast, we had Felix LeBlanc as the voice of Georges Bizet. Our narrator was Jane Potter, with additional voices from Travis Bowellen, Vincent Wynn, and me, Ashley Daniel Foote. As always, thanks to our producer, Mac McGilvery, and I'll see you at the opera.